Chinook. It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. One pattern most of us have become familiar with in one way or another is the series of steps involved in putting together an environmental impact statement. Notices get sent out, hearings are held, comment periods come and go, testimony is gathered, and a draft EIS is written. It's revised after more comment, and finally out comes a thick book. My stack of material from the Alaska OCS office is at least a foot high. Connie Wasink is the public information officer of the Alaska Outer Continental Shelf Office. It's her job to deliver the information on the calls for nominations of oil and gas leases to the people who need to know. What are the problems in getting the word out?
Well, we have personal visits and use radio, as we're doing here. In the opportunities we had, which were very great, we had some weather problems to confront us with getting to the bush out in the days before the call on Norton Sound. Here we've got the St. George Basin call just announced here in late July, and our intention is to make some trips out to communicate and with the local radio stations in that area before we would mount a series of trips to the villages in October before the end of the call. We're running out of time on this program, but the whole St. George Basin situation, and people have known that eventually there would be a call because we've had the St. George Basin on the schedule before during the last Ford administration, and so it's no surprise. The timetable is more of a surprise than the actual call in that area, that it's been on the back burner for a long time.
So now the call has been made, and is only... This is late July or early August, depending on when you're hearing this. And the comments have to be in by the end of October?
Right, yes. Mm-hmm. And I've got to use radio to get to people who, while they're in their fish camps, to listen to it and to, when we come to visit, to have some good questions for us to help them put their concerns together to give to us. Now, this deadline of the latter part of October is a very fixed deadline for the oil industry and related to get the nominations in. We do not shut the door October 31st to comments. We would like to have them in as soon after that as possible, but anybody who has a concern can write to us at any time. We've just got to get all the comments together in the week following, in the early November time, so that the people who present the wrap-up of the comments to the manager in our office for a resource portrayal of what the concerns are, what the resources are, what the conflicts are, the herring fishery, the salmon fishery, and all of that can be in one package with not a lot of important information left out because we haven't heard from people.
Do you think with the hunting and fishing season that in progress, or certainly will be by the time, it gives people enough time to think
well,
about it?
Well, if it were a brand new area, had nobody ever thought that the federal government, would open it up, I would say categorically, your question, you know, is going to cause me a lot of embarrassment. But the St. George Basin has been, as far as the point where the area was selected for an impact statement, and then the pressures from the state government to take it off the schedule were so great that Secretary Kleppe removed it, and then you had a new election and a new ball game and so forth. So people know, and actually we've had correspondence from some groups in the Dillingham area asking us when we were going to get going with the St. George Basin. They would like to see the thing go, you know, work its way through the course of the steps of the process, to learn more about it, to have it documented in this impact statement, to have a public hearing, to find out what people thought. They wanted us to get on with that. And so there's been a tug of war, is the best way of saying it, between the interests of going ahead, and as you probably know, industry feels that that's some of the area with the richest possibility of an oil and gas resource. And then when you look at it from the national point of view and gas lines and OPEC prices, put yourself in the place of the Secretary of the Interior, and I know you will find it's a difficult job.
But do you have any feel for what the people that are living in the area, what a feel for the kind of comments and concerns they have at all?
Well, I know that they will want, in the eventuality of having a lease sale and having industry out there, all the environmental protection that can be mounted. And if my exercise in listening to, in recent days here at the university, on the campus, the concerns and the regulations and the stipulations written for the Beaufort Sea is any example, we're practicing now for writing rigid stipulations for such an area as the St. George. So people should take some interest in what would then be past experience when we would go out. And the whole process is for is to gather information, not only from scientists, but people who live and work and use the area as their garden, for, as a matter of speaking, and the fish and in the area.
What kind of information is most useful? What kind of presentation?
Well, if they can make it in writing, number one, and work through the Bristol Bay Native Association or the Associated Village Council presidents to present information in a group effort is also valid, but we don't deny anyone who is an individual. We would like to know where they go fishing, approximately, what their catch is in general terms, kinds of things that are related to the production of subsistence and their needs from the Bering Sea, identified, listed. To say we don't want you to come, period, that doesn't do us any good. We have to have some feeling. Now, some feelings and emotions are all part of it, but some facts are also very important, very critical.
This may be another embarrassing question, but people feel that maybe they're sending out, gathering all this information, writing down their concerns, and it just goes to Washington and nobody ever looks at it. Do these comments have any weight?
Yes, in the impact statement that we're getting out this month, August, on the Beaufort Sea, every piece and every shred of information that was presented at the public hearing is going to find its way into that. It has found its way into that statement. Now, if a lot of people say pretty much the same thing, that will have to be concentrated into, you know, a few paragraphs rather than just reiterate throughout the statement. However, the public record has, of course, everybody's statement in it, and that's part of the kit of tools that the secretary has and the governor, in this case, and the Beaufort, have to make the decision. But then on the other side of the coin, you have to realize that this nation's energy policy says we're going to look for domestic sources of oil and gas. And until we rule out oil and gas as a foundation for our medicines and our cups that we drink coffee out of, plastics of that kind, and to run our boats and outboard motors and to run our cars, well, the secretary has to pull all of those things together.
The question I have is, though, is who actually sits down and reads a whole environmental impact statement?
Well, people on the staff of the secretary and in Guy Martin's office certainly do. Oh, they know very well what's in the statement.
So it's just not a big, thick book that somebody
no.
needs to hold.
There are different people, you know, whose area leads them to specific sections of the book and can discuss, knowing what's all in this book and what else has come in, can discuss with the secretary when he asks, for instance, a specific question about, in the future he might ask about the St. George Basin on the herring fishery. Well, then there's a fisheries biologist who has become very familiar with the concerns raised during this whole process that just began, in this case, this past July, and will be able to answer the secretary those questions that he's raised.
Is there, is the herring fishery and salmon fisheries, what else is tricky about the St. George Basin?
Well, the St. George Basin is filled with nutrients for all living things, and there's been some articles written about recently about scientists from both Russia and the United States going together to learn just what the circulation patterns are, the movement of these nutrients through this area, and that's why it's such a rich area in renewable resources. And at the same time, the oil industry says nobody, not even the Secretary of the Interior, has designated the spots where oil and gas will be found. That's a matter of nature. And the industry feels they have to look for where the highest probability is. And that their experts have said, unfortunately for the rest of the concerns, but that the truth of the matter is, they feel it's in the St. George Basin that they will find the largest pool of oil.
How about public hearings? Are there going to be public hearings?
There's public hearings for every single proposal we have.
We have a schedule for the St.
Yes.
George ones?
Yes. I don't know. I didn't bring my schedule with me. I would think that would be in the winter of 1981. Probably in February, something like that. I would just have to off the cuff tell you because I don't have it with me.
So people that are thinking about...
And there's another opportunity that you and I haven't discussed before, and that's since the guidelines were established newly by the Council on Environmental Quality. We have something, a whole new subject, and I'll briefly say that it's scoping, and the new format of the impact statement calls for the alternatives to the proposed action, which is this proposal on the St. George in this case, to be the major portion of the impact statement. In other words, they want public input and public discussion of a set of alternatives to the proposed action. And we have meetings for the scoping process to seek out those alternatives from people such as the ones that would be involved in this comment period later on. So if you fail to do something in the comment time, the next opportunity will be next winter when they get underway with the EIS, the environmental statement, and in advance of that, a scoping process to determine what alternatives people are interested in seeing discussed and what alternatives they feel that aren't necessary and why. That all has to be included in the new formatted new statements that we have to write, because the President's Council has decided to upgrade the value of the impact statement as a document that can be understood by the American public.
You've been listening to Connie Wasink, Public Information Officer of the Alaska Outer Continental Shelf Office. For Chinook Patterns, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles. Portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Profiles, and I'm Paula Schiller with a look between the lines at the Tundra Times. The Tundra Times is the oldest statewide newspaper in Alaska. It is native-owned by the Eskimo Indian Aleut Publishing Company, and it's largely native-operated by publisher and president Thomas Richards, Jr., and a full-time staff of five who work in a noisy office in downtown Anchorage. On the front page of the Tundra Times, under the name and under silhouetted scenes of rural life, are phrases in five native languages, from left to right, in Inupiaq, the people's heritage. In Athabascan, our land speaks. In Aleut, the Aleut speak. In Tlingit, informing and reporting. And from the Yupik, the way the Eskimos talk. The Tundra Times speaks with all those voices, but is it the spokesman for the Alaska natives, or is it something more or something somewhat less than that?
Not so much a spokesman. I think occasionally we take a great deal of our lead from the attitudes of the native community toward a variety of things happening in Alaska. Change, land issues, culture, subsistence, arts, almost everything that affects the native community. It is not officially recognized as the voice of the native people, but it is the oldest American Indian or Alaska Native owned newspaper in the United States. And it's the only privately operated Alaska Native newspaper in Alaska. It's also the oldest statewide Alaska newspaper. So it doesn't fit, I think a description of it as a voice of the native people is a little bit too narrow. I think we consider more of ourselves as a media, which tries to be as accessible as possible to all segments of the native community, and for people outside the native community who might have some observations to share. When we get into the realm of trying to at times be an opinion leader, mm-hmm. That's when things become dangerous. I don't know whether we'll sit the next election out or not, but we did after considerable thought and discussion with some of the statewide candidates last year, did try to enter into the political arena a bit as an opinion leader, and that proved, I think, a little dangerous. Politics, like anything else, any type of controversial area does bring dangers to any type of media when you try to exercise a leadership role. I think for the most part, once in a while we do feel compelled to make independent observations, but we try to pay a greater amount of attention to our responsibility as a media or forum for thought or for discussion of issues, rather than to try to act as the vehicle which focuses.
Well, do you have any idea how much weight you do carry in forming opinions?
Well, a lot of people, I think, might have varying views on that.
What do you think?
I think in terms of the accessibility of the paper to the native community, to villages, to leaders in the various organizations, we play a very strong role in allowing for opinion to be formed. But we don't willfully try to shape opinion, I don't believe. We may have once or twice, and every time we've done that, I think it's been it's compromised somewhat the role of the paper.
The role of any newspaper is to present the news, and the Tundra Times has narrowed the field down to the job of publishing native news. But in this state, that still covers a lot of territory. Is there any such thing as purely native news?
It's different only in the respect that I don't believe anybody does it like we do it. I mean, if we were unable to provide the attention that we are able to provide to these issues, I don't believe they would be covered very adequately. It's one thing for a major newspaper to have 10 or 12 desks in its newsroom and a number of sections, departments within the newspaper, and having Native Affairs being one of those. But it's another thing for a newspaper to be controlled, owned and controlled by a corporation of Alaska Natives with a concern that to the broadest extent possible that we provide coverage of Native issues. In terms of there being Native news, there certainly are Native issues, but I think the professional news judgments and the professional journalistic practices apply to any newspaper, television station, radio station. I think the principles of journalism are universal. We just try to apply those principles in dealing with issues that primarily concern Natives.
Are the readers of the Tundra Times then primarily Natives? The paper estimates that each copy is read by 7 people, and by their calculations, it reaches 42,000. Who reads the Tundra Times?
In terms of circulation, I think perhaps about 55 to 60% of our circulation is in the villages and in rural Alaska. Perhaps another 15% is in the urban centers of Alaska. And the balance of the circulation would be outside of Alaska, within primarily in the Washington, D.C., New York area, and among a substantial part of it is among bureaucrats, policymakers.
Who in Washington, D.C. would read the Tundra Times?
I think most of the key members of the legislative committees or the congressional committees that deal with issues affecting Alaska read it. A lot of members of the, I think, members of the financial community in New York, Chicago, San Francisco are included heavily among our readership, and much more so in the last 8 or 10 years and previous years, primarily because of the role of Native folks in the business community.
With so many outside readers, do you ever feel a temptation to talk to them rather than perhaps to the people in the villages?
Well, the paper paper primarily serves, strives to meet the communication needs of people in rural Alaska. We also recognize that it provides a role as being somewhat of a window on what's happening in the Alaska Native world for others. Frequently, we keep that in mind. Sometimes it's good news, sometimes it's not so good.
You let the bad news show.
Well, we let the bad news show. Certainly, we've got a responsibility to our readership. I think we try to cooperate in terms of, you might be referring to Native Corporation Affairs.
That's one of them.
We try to cooperate as much as possible. We're a Native corporation ourselves, and we're not without our problems, mm-hmm. So we try to understand problems that others have. We try to cooperate with people in leadership and management positions in the Native corporations. But we also recognize that they have shareholders who depend to a great extent upon us for information about their corporations. And they are the owners of the corporations. While the management may be in a leadership role, we recognize the people in the villages are the owners of the corporations. Sometimes we have to print some bad news. One example, I think I can One good example would be, I think, the problems that have been experienced in the last several years in the Nome Bering Straits area. I don't often write news stories anymore, but I had the very unfortunate responsibility last year of reporting on the front page that the Bering Straits Native Corporation had, by early 1978, accumulated losses in excess of $26 million. But I also had the distinct privilege last month of also writing one of my infrequent stories, reporting that the nonprofit arm of that corporation, Quirik, has made a dramatic recovery, pulling itself out of a very severe Chapter 11 bankruptcy situation, appearing to be nearly out of the woods. So it balances out. Sometimes you have to write some bad news, and sometimes you get the privilege of reporting some good news. As long as it's balanced properly, I think it's all right.
The question of balance invites a comparison with how other newspapers handle Native news.
Well, there's some newspapers, I think, with one or two exceptions, newspapers in Alaska that are controlled by non-Native corporations. Well, that includes everybody else, I guess, because we're the only newspaper that's controlled by a Native corporation. Newspapers that are controlled by non-Native corporations, with one or two exceptions, generally seize upon misfortunes of Native corporations in a big way. For example, one of the major daily newspapers in Anchorage, I think anytime there's some misfortune or some bad news concerning a Native corporation or Native individual, is tempted to place it on the front page, if not in a banner position, in a very prominent position on the front page. But if there's any promising development with the Native corporations or their organizations, I think you'd be lucky to see it on page 43 or 44. So we were very pleased to while we did use as the lead story last year the unfortunate financial situation of Bering Straits, we also used as a lead story in 48 point bold, extra bold headlines, the story that Quirik, the nonprofit arm of Bering Straits, is bouncing back from its bankruptcy. I don't think most other newspapers in Alaska would provide that kind of follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what your reputation among the readers and maybe other your colleagues in the other newspapers in the state is? Do you have a feel for that?
That's something I don't often like to discuss. I have a feel for it one way or the other, but you might talk to other people in the trade, or you might talk to other people in the business community or through the political leadership in the state, and they may have something to say about the reputation of the Thunder Times. We have a lot of friends, and I'll say that much. Please to say that. We wouldn't have been around as long as we hadn't.
The struggle for survival continues at America's oldest Native-owned newspaper. In our next program, we'll take a look at how the Thunder Times is changing to meet its responsibility to its readers, as well as to its stockholders. You've been listening to Thunder Times publisher Thomas Richards, Jr. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.